How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Have you voted in the 2015 Metro Vancouver Transportation and Transit plebiscite? Elections BC must receive your completed ballot package before 8 p.m. on Friday, May 29th. Or voters can drop off their completed ballot package before the close of voting at any plebiscite service office in Metro Vancouver. For more information, call Elections BC at 1-800-661-8683 or visit elections.bc.ca/plebiscite. This message is brought to you by Elections BC.
Yo, this is Speech, and right now you're listening to CITR 101.9. Peace.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skahuya, Talitin, Homasque Mustail.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time with. If I had a box just for wishes and dreams that had never come true, the box would be empty except for the memory of how they were answered by you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go.
Good morning. Touchscreen, come on in.
This is Language to Language. I'm your host, Woody. Kaunsinga inu dikya an. Dik is hat agen. Zetlana auto hat. In Haida, I'm called Kaunsinga. Kauen means walking, Shingai is day. But that's a man who walks in a room carrying a newborn child, someone who brings a special day. And I'm Kais Hat Ai, which means that's how they refer to us northern Haidas. After the ice, all of us Haidas, all the Haida people, humans, lived on the south end of what's now Haida Gwaii. And then as the ice receded and the ocean level began to rise to return to its normal level, we started moving north to try to get back to where we were on what's now the Alaska side. And it took about, I don't know, to get about partway up, took maybe 50 years, maybe less. Partly because they had to transport everything on a very rocky coast. And it would stop when someplace seemed to be okay to live, but then the ocean kept coming in until they reached a place about midway, which was today where is an area called Skidigat Channel. And we stayed there for about 300 years, 200-300 years, because it was sheltered by some small islands. And then a decision was made to continue north. So, continued to the northwest corner of Graham Island, which is part of the Haida Gwaii Archipelago. And there was, it wasn't an island at that time. It was called T'Islangai. T'Islangai means like a rock sticking up out of the ground. It wasn't quite an island, it wasn't surrounded by water. But later, it became known as T'Islangai. T'Is means sort of halfway or sticky, part way, you know. But T'Is, it's something very old. T'Is is also some lava rocks that fuse together. They're found on that island called T'Islangai. There was a volcano to the northwest of Haida Gwaii. I don't know how many miles offshore it was. But anyway, some of those fused rocks were on the island, so that's why it became known as T'Islangai. Also, we were isolated, I guess you might say, or separated from the other body of Haidas to the south, and we're there by ourselves for quite a while. So K'is also can mean a complete unit in and of itself. But we were that way until some other Haidas arrived. They came from the north, though. They went clear around the Pacific Ocean and returned back. And they became the people we call Raven, and we are the Eagle. And so anyway, that's where the name Kis Hade or Kis Hatai, that's old humans, we're the old ones. And I assume each of the other groups had history keepers. I knew only one from Masset, and all the ones that I grew up around, the last one died in 1997, I think it was, at age 97. So I'm somewhat of a history keeper, carrying history. And but I also enjoy writing. Once in a while, as long as I don't have to dig into my memory to write down the stuff I was trained, the problem is once I write some of these things down, I no longer have to remember them, and they tend to disappear. Excuse me. But anyway, I wrote a story I intended for it to become a feature film. And I think I called it simply Fada Dinks or Fada Dinks Birthday. One of my heroes as I was growing up was a man who's not much older than I am, 4 years older maybe, Fred Guthrie. He and his brother, Francis, tall, slender guy, of course, called Slim, and Fred's nickname was Dinks. He lived with his, they lived with their grandfather, Yastung. Two Ravens was what he was called in Haida. I don't remember his wife's Haida name, but I didn't know her very well. Her name was Julia. And but anyway, I used to follow Dinks around as a kid. They lived two houses away from us. And so I borrowed his name for this character, Fada Dinks. And first he was called Uncle Dinks. And then somebody called him Father, you know. And then pretty soon it was Father Dinks, and the kids couldn't say Father Dinks, so it became Fada Dinks. So anyway, I'll read you a little bit about what I wrote. This isn't in a script form. I've got that somewhere else. But anyway, this part is, let's see, I think I had an introduction here that sort of, okay. Dysfunction is rampant in Native communities. A combination of virtually no employment, alcohol, drug abuse, sex abuse, and the after effects of residential schools and the effects of forced assimilation have resulted in communities and individuals afflicted with just about every social dysfunction imaginable. Government didn't try to kill us. They took away our reason to be alive. So gradually, as the resurgence of restoring tribal cultural values gains momentum, the levels of alcohol and drug abuse have been declining. Unfortunately, the residues from all of the other ills keeps the communities in the morass of control by the most dysfunctional. Unlike the non-Native communities, this community includes non-Native families, Native demographics tend to remain fairly constant. Families remain for very long periods of time, remain together, and even if they leave, they go somewhere else to live and work, they're still from that place where they were born and raised. Thus, when dealing with generational problems like drug addiction, alcoholism, and other compulsive behavior, the problems persist for very long periods of time. Feuds that began a century ago are never forgotten. The young are told to go get an education, come home to help your people. They do, and when they return to help their people, they are the first targeted for abuse. Over time, the ones with true hardship leadership possibilities leave in frustration, while the noisiest or most aggressive of the dysfunctional gain and maintain control of the community. They learn their lessons well from the Europeans. The community did not suddenly become dysfunctional. It took years for it to deteriorate to its present state. Restoring it to a state of health will require a great deal of effort and commitment, and once the healing begins, the experiences are cumulative. Unfortunately, the children have become accustomed to the compulsive behavior of their parents and others. Once the adults begin to change, the children become confused. They can no longer predict the behavior of their parents. Thus, as the healing process begins, there's a period of serious uncertainty in the children's world, but given time, they'll adjust to the changes. If there's to be any healing, it has to come from inside the community and at great expense to those willing to try. Fada Dinks is that kind of a story. This is a fictional community made up of a number of towns and characters. The characters are composites of real people. In 1976, the Alaska State Government provided 26 Native villages with satellite dishes for telephone and television services. From that point on, the social ills skyrocketed. A couple of Native grandparents decided to take back their grandchildren and enlist the aid of other selected grandparents. The population mix of the community story include non-Native parents, children and grandparents. They too are all caught up in the same social morass, and the non-native, non-Indian grandparents gradually become involved in the effort to take back the grandchildren. They have to fight the bootleggers, drug dealers, the tribal council, the police, the church, and some of their own tribal elders to do it. A couple of the grandparents are severely beaten but not deterred. All during this time, the kids are being kids, playing, exercising their imaginations, and having great adventures. The kids sense that their grandparents are doing something, but they do not know specifically what it is. Something has seemed to change. There seems to be a danger in the air, causing the children to be apprehensive. From time to time, mention is made of a child being abused, but we never see it. However, we do see the negative effects on the child, and we see the effects of healing provided by Father Denks's birthday parties. At the end of summer, before the beginning of the new school year, elders held a ceremony for the kids. Each of the boys was given a small eagle feather, while each of the girls received a hummingbird feather. This included the non-native kids. They were instructed that any time life gets difficult, use the feather, ask the spirit world for assistance, and it'll come. So Charlie Jim is a 36-year-old man of Native American ancestry. When he was born, his parents didn't have a crib for him, so he slept in a dresser drawer. An uncle, in honor of a comic strip character who always slept in a dresser drawer, dubbed him K.O. K.O. grew up in a fairly well-balanced home situation in a small Indian town of Pacific Northwest rainforest country. During his teens, the drinking in the village had gotten very bad, and although he had the advantage of being raised primarily by grandparents, he was affected by the compulsive behavior of nearly everyone in the village. The old people treated him and the other children with loving kindness and worked at passing on the tribal knowledge to them. K.O. did not want to be like the men in the village, and he promised himself, "It'll never happen to me." Unfortunately, as time passed, he permitted his grandparents' teachings to fade, and he took on the behavior he vowed to avoid. K.O. is now a federal marshal, constantly at odds with his superiors. His world is out of control. At home, he verbally and psychologically abuses his wife and children and has a temper that frightens him. In January 1999, K.O. walked into a sponsored workshop in progress to deliver a message. It was the wrong workshop. As he entered the room, he heard a facilitator state, "Childhood does not have to be miserable." Shocked by the statement, K.O. fled from the room, and once out in the hallway, he found himself crying. It was the first time he'd cried since he was a small boy. K.O. realized that he wasn't crying just for himself, but for his wife and children, too. "I'm making their lives miserable," he thought aloud. Late afternoon, same day, near dark, K.O. walked out of the government offices building into a lightly falling snow en route to his car. He glanced upward and saw a bald eagle appear out of the gloom and pass about 20 feet above his head. He paused momentarily to watch it fly overhead and disappear into the thickening snow. He turned away from the eagle and continued toward his car when he spotted something small drifting slowly earthward. It was a small feather, a small eagle feather. He pulled the fleece-lined glove from his left hand and reached to catch it. When it touched his hand, he suddenly flashed on the image of a tribal elder handing him just such a feather. The image of the old man's face and the feather were so vivid, so real, K.O. recoiled and nearly fell down. Uncertain as to what had just happened, he shook his head to clear it of the images and glanced quickly around him to see if anyone had noticed. K.O. hurried on to his car, got in, started the cold engine. As the engine turned over and caught, the radio issued forth the strains of a familiar Christmas carol sung by a chorus of children. The song conjured up another memory, a children's choir singing that same carol. K.O., puzzled by the timing of the memories, held up and examined the small eagle feather he was still gripping in his left hand. It happened again. He saw the same tribal elder extending to him a small eagle feather. Startled, Kale fumbled and put the feather in the glove compartment, snapped on his headlights, and hastily drove out of the parking lot, heading for home 2 miles north, oblivious to the Christmas decorations. Darkness came rapidly. The snowfall was increasing. It was Friday, and all the other drivers on the road were also trying to get home, to get off the highway as soon as possible. Driving was much more treacherous than usual. The swirling snow and blinding headlights made it difficult for Cale to concentrate on his driving. He tried his best to maintain his focus on the road, but it was interrupted time and again by vivid memory flashes. Emotionally drained and partially blinded by the headlights of an oncoming truck caused Cale to nearly lose control of the car. Finally, sweating and shaken, unable for the moment to continue driving, Cale pulled over to the side of the road, stopped and put his head down on the steering wheel in silent relief. Heart pounding and eyes closed, Cale saw himself just that morning, angrily yelling at his two children. The memory is interrupted by the cherubic strains of O Holy Night, playing quietly on the car radio. When the song ended, the announcer said, "Only 2 more weeks till Christmas. If you haven't been good to your kids, it isn't too late to begin. Remember, Santa watches parents too." Cale jerked upright in his seat and looked around like he wasn't sure where he was or what was happening. What? He began to question, but then a montage of old memories interrupted and deluged him. Begins inside an old house, cozily cluttered, a wood-burning stove and a kettle steaming, freshly baked loaves of bread being taken out of the oven, pictures of hurt and anger, happiness and laughter all mixed together. Cale, nearly at wit's end, heard a public service announcement on his radio, inviting adults who grew up in alcoholic, drug addiction, or other dysfunctional families to attend a local adult children of alcoholics meetings entitled Surviving Christmas. A few minutes later, at home, Cale made a long-distance phone call. When the other party answered, Cale said, "Hello, Dad." At the other end of the line, a man who looks like the elder in Cale's memories flash. Everyone calls him Father Dinks. He sensed something is wrong. "Hi, Cale. Tell me what it is." Cale told him he'd become exactly what he promised himself would never happen to me. He then asked Father Dinks how to get back. The old man told him, "Trust your feelings. That's why creation gave us those things. Trust them. Do you have the feather your grandfather gave you?" Cale paused and answered, "I think I just got it back. I got to run, got a meeting to go to." Father Dinks hung up the phone, turned to his wife, Nana, and told her that there was good news. Cale was awake. "I think you better go. We have a chance to get them back." This is where the story changed. This is where Father Dinks and his wife, this is part of his memory, I guess, are talking. They tell him that it's time they can get the kids back. Fada and Nana are both in their 60s. Fada spent most of the time carving seemingly magical things. Nana, only 5 foot tall, was fearless and woe-betide any person who hurt one of her precious grandchildren. Everybody said that. Whether it was a broken slingshot or a broken heart, she could fix anything. A couple of months earlier, after their grandchildren, Son, that is nicknamed, and the others had spent a miserable night listening to the drunken arguing and fighting of their parents, Son's youngest sister, fondly known as Small Eyes, went to Fada and Nana's house. The moment they saw her, they knew what was wrong. This was not the first time his son and daughter-in-law had kept the kids awake all night with their drinking and fighting. However, Father Dinks greeted her with his sunniest voice. "Hello, Small Eyes. How's my ray of sunshine today?" Small Eyes stood with head down, and whispered a few words that struck Father Dink like a knife to his heart. Father Dinks, I don't want to be alive in this life anymore. Stunned, Father Dinks had trouble speaking, but asked her, if you don't want to be alive in this life, which life would you like to be alive in, Small Eyes? She looked up at him with hopeful eyes. A place where there are birthday parties, a place where kids laugh and sing and get presents and nobody yells at them. Father Dinks is taken aback, but quite quickly recovers and says to his wife, Ja, Nana, isn't today my birthday? Not waiting for the answer, he goes on to say, by God, today is my birthday. Let's have a birthday party. So began Father Dink's birthday parties. The kids soon learned that whenever they're having trouble, they go see Father Dink's and Nana Esther. Father and Nana soon picked up on the messages from the children. If a child came by and shyly asked, Father Dinks, is today your birthday? They knew that there was trouble at home or someone had hurt the child. However, the child called out, hey, Father Dinks, when's your birthday? Everything was okay. One day as Father Dinks was working on his carvings, Nana came in the room, sat down heavily, put the hem of her apron to her eyes and began to sob. Terrified, Father Dink stopped his work and asked what's wrong. Nana cried a long time before answering. She lifted her tear-stained face to peer into the face of her concerned husband and answered, when we were small, we lived with our grandparents. They loved us. They taught us. They protected us. We let government and church and everybody else take our grandchildren away from us. Look how much they're suffering. Dads and brothers, even grandfathers, do things to little girls and the boys that our grandparents would have killed them for. And we sit and watch it. Bootleggers sell our kids booze. Others get them stuck on those drugs and nobody does a thing about it. We have to take our grandchildren back. Father Dinks agrees. They enlist the aid of some of the other grandparents. Some were excluded because they were some of the worst child abusers and tried to work out a plan for the protection of the kids. They really did not know where to start and were afraid that of some of the young people. Father Dink spoke up and told others what Small Eyes said. She didn't want to be alive in this life anymore. He experienced the worst pain of his life. We're going to have to do something, he said. Someone suggested they send for their son, Keo, but Father said, no, we have to do this by ourselves. It is our responsibility to the little ones. The grandparents decided to start with a bootlegger, High Grade. Father Dinks and another of the elders, Padna, went to see him. They told me they heard he was selling booze to kids. High Grade denied it. And so as the two old men started to leave, Padna turned and told him, I hope we don't have to visit you again over this thing. A few days later, Son and one of his buddies, Tumi, visit Padna. They were obviously upset but avoided saying anything about what was bothering them. Padna was able to get the boys to talk. They revealed to him that some of the teenage boys were drunk the night before. They bought the booze, some homebrew from High Grade. Padna listened but offered no comment other than agree that it was a bad thing. They also told Padna that while they were drunk, some teenage boys beat up two little boys, Himboy and Steamboat Stanley. Both them have black eyes and swollen lips. Padna went to see Father Dinks and told him of his conversation with the two boys. The two men went to High Grade's house and walked in without knocking. High Grade was surprised and asked what they wanted. Padna was an unusually strong man, and without answering, he reached so quick High Grade was unable to avoid him and grabbed a handful of the side of the man's neck and began to squeeze. The pain was so intense, High Grade was unable to make a sound. Father Dinks asked him, did you sell boots to the boys? Tell the truth and he'll let go of your neck. High Grade nodded yes. partner released him. His partner said as he extended his hand for a handshake, "We gotta go." Highgrade reached for partner's hand. Partner gripped Highgrade's hand and began to squeeze. As partner slowly increased the pressure, Highgrade's face became a mask of shocked disbelief. Partner quietly said, "You've been causing a lot of pain to our grandchildren. Now it's your turn." The pressure increased, Highgrade's screams increased, then the sound of bones in his hand being crushed cut off the screams. Highgrade fell over in a dead faint. A couple of days later, hand in cast, Highgrade showed up with a cop and tried to get the two old men arrested. They don't deny the allegation. Instead, partner asked Highgrade, "Selling more booze to the kids?" The cop warned the two men as they turned to leave. Highgrade sees partner glance down at his uninjured left hand. The elders went to the drug dealer and talked to him and his friends about what they're doing to the kids. Not only did the young men laugh at them, they threatened them with violence. They didn't mind their own business. The incident did not deter the elders, and they tried again. Then one evening, Father Dink staggered into his house, face all bloodied. He told Nana the young men beat him up and threatened to kill him. He went on to tell the pain of watching what was happening to grandchildren was worse than his fear of death. The incident brought home to the other elders the fact they had a tough job ahead. The grandmothers made medicine and used it on ones that had been sexually molesting the young. During the time they were under the power of the grandmothers, they were given messages that any time they even think about doing dirty things to the little ones, their genitals will burn like hot pitch has been poured on them. The abusers realized what was going on, reported to the police the old women had been drugging them. Two of the women were arrested, and news media branded them as witches. The church turned against them. They soon realized that their fight to take back the grandchildren was a life and death struggle, but they were determined to save the grandchildren. Cale returned home from a visit and was shocked at the tension in the village. Old friends, even family members, were cool toward him. In fact, some outright ignored him. He asked his parents what's going on. They told him he wants to stay and help, but tell him, no, this thing has to be done from the inside. They see you as an outsider. Cale protests that this is his home, but they prevail. So when he returns to his office, he alerts his superiors as to what's going on, and to get the police to back off and at minimum leave the elders alone. In late summer, just before the beginning of the new school year, the elders gather the kids they've been working with at a place called Where the Eagle Bathes. A ceremony was performed where each of the girls is given a hummingbird feather. Hummingbird is the messenger to the spirit world, and the small boys each a small feather, eagle feather. The group was told that when bad things start to happen, to talk to the feather, tell it what they want, and help will come. Anyway, that's not the whole story, but that's kind of get the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice. When did you write that?
About 10 years ago.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And always, you know, something always fascinated me was stories about Raven and Coyote.
Mm-hmm.
In these stories, the rules don't apply, like time and space.
Mm-hmm.
You can move from one place to another instantaneously or get there before you left. You can walk on air upside down. You can do anything.
Yeah.
And so when you create characters that can do these things, it's so much fun to see what they can do, or what, because you can make them do anything you want.
Yeah.
And but it's always fascinated me was what I refer to as a bucket of misery. The residential schools were designed to destroy the tribal system.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's, with a great deal of pride, many of the native people in Canada say we're not as bad as the Americans. They used the army to kill people and all the rest of it. You kill people, the pain is gone. But in this system, they took away the reason to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pain never ends. It goes on for generation after generation after generation. But it's not to say one is worse than the other. And the unfortunate thing is that this isn't unique. It's been going on for thousands of years. Ever since people started switching to what I call a cash economy,
mm-hmm.
to where now that they had some sort of currency to represent whatever trade goods that they were trading, people no longer had to work for a living. Not quite the same way. They would make things for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so people started buying other people. And when you take a look at the church, it's also a power structure. That's what it's all about, is power.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter how good a sermon it is. The better the sermon, the more money they get. You know, people aren't going to put money in a collection plate if they're not listening to something interesting.
Yeah.
I heard a story about that. About this old priest was about to retire, so his replacement was sent, a much younger man. And so he was shadowing, you know, just following around the old priest, mm-hmm. learning what he did. And on Sunday, the priest got up, and when he preached the sermon, you know, he had everybody's attention for about an hour. And after it was over, the young priest asked him, he says, "How did you do that?" He said, "Do what?" "The way you were able to hold everybody's attention for as long as you did." Oh, he said, "You see that pitcher up there on the pulpit? You mean the pitcher of water?" "Yeah," he said, "but it's half vodka. So when I start running out of steam, I take a little shot of water, and that keeps my energy level up." So the next Sunday, it was the young priest's turn, and he was so nervous, he just put straight vodka in there.
Oh, no.
When he started preaching, even the babies didn't cry. He just mesmerized them. And afterward, he asked the old priest, "Well, how'd I do?" He said, "There's a couple of things that we're going to have to talk about." He says, "Like what?" And he said, "Well, for example," he says, "Samson slew Goliath. They didn't kick the crap out of him." Well, actually, he used stronger language than that.
Yeah.
So, but it's kind of funny, you know, people are afraid to laugh when you make jokes about religion.
Mm-hmm. It's
because
true.
It's based on fear. They're scared that God's going to smite them dead. But anyway, one of my other characters is a guy named Chinubby, and he's sort of a Cherokee folk hero. And right now I'm working on rewriting a script that's had many different names. I think the last title I used was Before the Raven Cries. And it's a story about a boy who's traveling with his parents on about an 18 or 20-foot cabin cruiser on the ocean. And as they're going along, they hit some underwater obstruction, probably what's called a deadhead, a log that's floating practically underwater. And anyway, the engine stopped, and they realized that the propeller had struck this underwater thing, and where the shaft goes through the hull to the propeller, it's called a stuffing box. And that was damaged, so the water is just pouring in. And they're probably 100 meters offshore, maybe not quite that far, and there's only one life jacket. And the mother doesn't swim. So the father decides to put the life jacket on his son while he and the mother talked, and he was to swim ashore with the boy and come back with the life jacket and get his wife. So he got the boy ashore and left him standing on a rock, and as he's swimming back out, his wife started screaming because the boat was going under and her feet were tangled in some rope. So he let go of the life jacket and swam as hard as he could, but the boat went under with her on it. He dove down to save her and didn't come up. So when a search party came looking, The boy was still standing on the rock. He'd been standing there for hours. And at the funeral, he was about eight years old. And his grandmother sat next to him and put her arm around him and said, "It's all right to cry." He said, "Nobody's ever going to make me cry." And he said, "It wouldn't have happened if my dad didn't go back to help my mother. I'm not going to help nobody, and I don't want nobody to help me." So he's raised by his grandparents. And his grandfather started training him in the old ways to become a clan chief. And so it was pretty strenuous, the physical training that he goes through, and swimming in the wintertime, learning how to stay in the cold water without dying of hypothermia, a bunch of things. So in the story, he's put in the ocean during stormy weather in September, and he has to swim ashore, and then he has 23 days to make it home. He has a bunch of islands that he has to cross from island to island, and all he had with him is a bag with a little bow for starting fires, and he has a knife and a stick, a war stick for defending himself, and he has a rain cape made of cedar bark, a hat, a vest made of sea otter fur, and he has a short cedar bark skirt and moccasins made from sea lion. It's very thick, very durable material. So anyway, he starts and he finds four teenagers that have been shipwrecked. A couple of them are injured, a couple of them are sick. He doesn't want to have anything to do with them. He's not going to help anybody. So he leaves them, and then one of the things his grandfather insisted on that he learn suddenly came loud and clear. To become a man, you have to be kind and gentle to the weaker ones and to your sisters. So there was two boys and two girls, so he turns around, goes and gets them. But he exhibits his displeasure, I'll put it that way, at them being with him, by pretending to not only not speak English, he doesn't understand it. So in the journey to get back to the village, all sorts of things happen to them, and he's got 23 days to go. And the one boy is jealous of him because the girl who had been his girlfriend sees that this character is the one that's going to provide the best means of survival, so she sticks close to him. The guy gets jealous. Oh, one of the other things is he has a piece of string that each day he ties a knot in the string so that he'll know when he's getting close to his 23-day deadline. And the jealous boy sees him doing that, and when he isn't looking, he takes the string and he ties an extra knot in it. And anyway, finally, a helicopter, Coast Guard finds him by... because one of the cell phones is still working partially. It worked for a while and then cut out and work and cut out. And so they locate him and comes to pick him up and offers him a ride. And this is, by according to the knots and the string, it's his last day. He doesn't realize he has one more day. But he decides, no, I'm going to finish this ordeal and by myself. I'm not going to take a ride in a helicopter. So he goes. And that night, well, he knows that next day the next day is the deadline. He has to be there in the morning. But he's in a place called Yalkeek. It's called Raven's Food. There's a big rock, outcropping a rock that looks like someone sculpted a large black raven. So that's where he spends the night. And a point at which the raven turns white and becomes his mother. And he cries and runs to her, calling, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." And she consoles him, and he tells her he's sorry for being so mad at them for leaving him. And she starts singing a lullaby. And as he's falling asleep, she's got holding him in her arms. He notices something's changed, and he realizes the song's changed. And he opens his eyes, and it's his father. His father's holding him, singing a tired paddler song. And his father says, "Son, I'm proud of the man you're becoming." And then he falls asleep and wakes up. The next day, he's faced with having failed. And as he gets close to the village is surrounded by men waiting for him. It's called Itkadadanga. That means he has to become like a deer. In other words, he has to elude the predators, the ones who are waiting to stop him. But he doesn't think there's anybody there because he's missed the deadline. And as he's walking, suddenly one of his uncles who had trained him popped up in front of him with his war stick and started moving toward him. And he says, "Yesterday was my last day." And the uncle says, "You counted wrong," and attacked him. So he has to fight off his uncle's attacks and then stuns his uncle with his club. Well, and then another uncle comes along and he has to fight him too. And I haven't decided on how to end it. I have, but I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, I don't like to really write violent stuff, but what I like to do is to write that shows the effects of the violence, mm-hmm. rather than the violence itself.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have some music over there?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to play a George Harrison song called "Isn't It a Pity?"
Not too many people.
kind of day to day, and today's in the U.S. it's Memorial Day. I guess it's called Remembrance Day here in Canada. And I served in the U.S. Armed Forces for 4 years, the United States Navy, and so did my brother. And during the Vietnam unpleasantness, in a village of a little over 300, there were 33 of us in uniform from my village. And it wasn't because of patriotism. We put on those uniforms because this is our home. It doesn't matter the flag that's flying over it. This is my home. And we hide us. I assume the same for the others. We feel very strong responsibility to protect our homelands, to save what we have left. And so that's what it is for me today. You know, some of the guys didn't make it home. But war doesn't really fix anything. I just absolutely believe that the only thing war is good for is for people to make money off of selling guns and bombs and all the rest of it. And the veterans, since ancient times, back in the ancient Egyptians and before them, veterans, when they're done with you like a dirty shirt, they just throw you aside. You're of no use anymore. We need someone who will get out there and be a shining example of valor, all the glory. And that's why I feel so strongly about what our Prime Minister is doing. He's making people hate Canada. And of course there's going to be more and more of those things happening, because every time we drop a bomb on her, we're not even talking about the people that killed. They're not part of ISIS. You know, they're just collateral damage. So anyway, those are my own particular feelings about it. And so anyway, for the guys and the women that served in the armed forces and those who didn't make it home, and those that are in faraway places or even here at home wearing that uniform, all I can say is I'm proud to have been one of you. So keep it up. You're doing a good job. Well done. So we'll talk to you next Monday. In the meantime, we'll just listen to George Harrison with his It's a Pity.
Last time on CITR, you heard that some kids couldn't afford to enroll in their local YMCA programs.
Oh, no. My God!
But this June 7th, Wapow. There's Megathon!
Cycle, swim, run, and stretch to raise money for more spaces in YMCA youth programs.
Bam!
Go to www.vanymcamegathon.ca to create, join, or donate to a Megathon team.
Wow!
On June 7th, be somebody's hero. Wakapa does a wee bam! Wakapa! Bam zoe kapow!
Bam zoe pa waka.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Myself as old for years now.
Singing in the same garage, always singing.